I'm speaking with Alex Bradley. Alex is a member of the Pittsburgh Organizing Group and a supporter of the Pittsburgh G20 Resistance Project. Alex, welcome to No One's Legal Radio.
Nice to be here.
Alex, later this month in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the G20 will be meeting in your city. And I'm wondering if you can lay out for us what actually is going to happen in Pittsburgh. There were large-scale protests against the G20 in London last year. Here in Montreal, we were protesting the G20 back in 2000, but it's evolved, certainly. It's become a crucial part of how global capital is sort of rehabilitating itself. So can you talk a bit about what actually is going to happen in Pittsburgh in terms of the official G20 meeting and the grassroots resistance that's being organized?
Well, about 4 months ago, a little less than 4 months ago, we found out that the G20 was going to be in Pittsburgh, which was obviously a bit of a surprise to us and I think to everyone else. Basically, it'll be the group of 20, which is the 19 different countries, some of the most powerful economies around the world, plus the UE, will be meeting in Pittsburgh. This will include all of the heads of state from those countries. It will include the chief governors of financial bodies, the WTO, the IMF, the World Bank. They'll all be here, along with other multinational kind of institutions. There'll be a lot of corporate lobbyists and probably about, they say, 2,000 media and about 4,000 police. I guess the purpose of the meeting, ostensibly, that they've declared is kind of to the next step in solving the global financial crisis that has kind of, you know, devastating hundreds of millions of people around the world. And so they will be talking about things such as restructuring and refinancing the International Monetary Fund. They'll be talking about different countries' priorities in terms of France wanting to increase regulation to this or that degree and not, you know, Britain not wanting to, et cetera, et cetera. Basically, I guess from our perspective, that is the perspective of people who are anti-authoritarians or are involved in different communities of resistance that have been working locally or kind of see themselves as part of a broader global justice movement or resistance. We kind of see the summit, or we place it kind of in this endless series of crises that have been happening and that will always continue to happen so long as global capitalism remains intact, in which a crisis occurs and then, you know, an institution, in this case the G20, is kind of tasked with using that as an opportunity to restructure the global economy for the benefit of the few and at the expense of the many. And so that's kind of what they'll be doing in Pittsburgh, and we're, of course, organizing resistance to that.
Alex, whenever a major summit like the G20 or the G8 is held in a particular city, there's always PR about why that particular city was chosen or why that particular city is hosting the summit. So why Pittsburgh? What are the proponents of the G20? What's the mayor or various congresspeople or the U.S. government saying for why Pittsburgh was chosen? And what's the real reason for why it's in Pittsburgh?
Sure. From the perspective being articulated by the state, which is, you know, President Obama, down to our local level, the G20 is coming here because they feel that Pittsburgh is a symbol of kind of the new green economy. It is a symbol of kind of the transition from industrial manufacturing-based economy to a new kind of green robotics, service-based economy. And so Obama is trying to kind of use that as a way to say to other cities that are in decline or suffering greatly that there is kind of light at the end of the tunnel. Pittsburgh hasn't really experienced the collapse that other cities have experienced. We never had a housing bubble, so we never had, you know, a housing collapse. And that's kind of where they're coming from in that. I think from a crass political perspective or maybe a more honest political perspective is that Obama has basically trying to buttress his working class credentials, and Pittsburgh is seen around the country and actually still remains as a very kind of working class city in which, you know, it's very non-pretentious, kind of the, you know, stereotype, but some truth to it, you know, of the steel worker with the beard or, you know, here, rather than say you all, we would say yinzers. So he's kind of trying to play on that idea of insulating himself from, you know, he not being a you know, liberal intellectual, but just regular working person.
Alex, on the side of the opposition and resistance to the G20, there's a range of opinion, of course. You have on the one side the loyal opposition, as I call it, people like Bono and Bob Geldof, who want to sit down and essentially collaborate with world leaders and these institutions about ways to change the world and make it a better place. And on the other end, you have people who fundamentally resist the premise of what the G20 or the G8 and these other institutions are all about. And I suspect that as an anti-authoritarian group within the Pittsburgh G20 Resistance Project, you're on the latter end of that spectrum. Could you talk about, both in the short term, how you see resistance and opposition to the G20 locally in Pittsburgh, and more in the long term, what are the premises on which the Pittsburgh G20 Resistance Project is coming together to oppose the G20?
On a short-term basis, which is what the PGRP is, it's a temporary, essentially, coalition or network or whatever word you kind of want to use to describe it. It's a broader effort that came together shortly after we heard that the G20 was going to be here, and it really brought together anti-authoritarians from a spectrum of groups and individuals, people identified in very different ways, but kind of coming together under a kind of common banner and organizing framework in which we could use to open up space to resist the summit. So for the long term, I don't think the PGRP will continue, but certainly the struggle that has brought it together will continue and has been going on for a very long time. In the short term, I'd say that the PGRP, its kind of main task is to open up space, and that's really what we're trying to do, is create a framework in which other people can plug in and have their voices heard and actualize some significant resistance to the summit. In the long term, resistance to the G20, I think, I'm not really sure. As what we've seen, I guess, in the global justice movement is that as soon as a large group of people organize in very effective ways to militantly oppose them, that kind of institution loses legitimacy and is destabilized, and kind of global capital has to search for new avenues in which to achieve its objectives. And so, you know, I think right now we're seeing the importance of the G20 because the G8 was kind of discredited as an institution in which to turn to. And so they were like, well, let's make it a slightly bigger thing and bring in some more countries that have still capital reserves and such. So in the long term, I don't know the G20 specifically, but certainly, you know, there'll be a new institution and a new crisis. And, yeah, we'll continue our resistance.
It's been argued rather than us being in a crisis, capitalism is crisis, and
sure,
capitalism is the crisis.
Absolutely.
And that means this stuff happens day to day. And I know that through your work with the Pittsburgh Organizing Group, and I know through reading the various materials that have been put out in terms of callouts by the Pittsburgh G20 Resistance Project, there is an emphasis on understanding the local dimension and local day-to-day struggles. This is something we could talk about for hours about any city and any regional area, but could you provide our listeners with just a brief overview of what some of those local struggles are in Pittsburgh?
Sure. And I think you're absolutely right that capitalism is always, I mean, essentially it is the crisis. But for, you know, people on the street, the crisis can be worse or it can be better. And so I think right now we're kind of seeing around the world a bit of the worse of it. As far as Pittsburgh, I think the main thing people would have to know in looking at the context here is that this is a city that was massively we were completely gutted. We were completely deindustrialized. We went from around a population of 650,000 in 1950, and now we have a population of 310,000. So essentially our entire steel industry collapsed. Almost all of the plants closed within, you know, a relatively short period of time. An entire, essentially, generation of Pittsburgh workers went elsewhere. They kind of refer to it as the Pittsburgh diaspora because so many people from Pittsburgh are now based in other cities but still identify with Pittsburgh as their home. So there's a very strong kind of city and regional identity here, and that kind of plays into things to some degree. I guess in terms of local problems, absolutely. I think one of the main things that we've been trying to do with the G20 is to talk to people that about the ways that things like structural adjustment aren't just something that happens to other countries, but structural adjustments are something that are always happening, and that the kind of same neoliberal prescriptions that are imposed on other countries are also imposed on people locally, and that we see that in it, especially in places like Pittsburgh, in the push to kind of break the transit union locally, to privatize city services, to kind of cut back, and kind of the elimination of the concept of the public good and promotion of the idea that the marketplace will solve our problems. And that manifests for people in many, many different ways. Whether it's, you know, kind of everywhere, I guess, the explosion of kind of security industries and kind of the privatization of repression and control of public spaces at the same time that there's a further militarization of the police and kind of expanding markets for profit. So the problems that people face in Pittsburgh are very connected to the problems that people face elsewhere, and the attempts to kind of defund services from, you know, that the city once provided is the same thing that's happening around the world. So we hope that by going door to door and talking to our neighbors, we can make those connections and so that they see that what happens here during the G20 isn't just about people elsewhere, but it's also about what is happening in our city on a long-term basis.
Alex, summit protests are sort of like extreme sports for activists, and I say that having been to them, and you know it's a critical way of looking at it. But with just a few weeks before the G20 begins in Pittsburgh, it's going to be happening later this month. You're in the midst of those extreme sports. We're organizing of medics, logistics, convergence spaces. The call out to protest against the G20 in Pittsburgh has been made for people to come from outside. So could you speak about that dimension, the organizing dimension right now that you guys find yourself in Pittsburgh? I know that you know, in these situations, it's inevitable that the media emphasizes violent protests, and there's all kinds of talk about security perimeters and no-go zones and snipers and the rest of it. And then on our end, you know, there's just the organizing that goes into making an effective protest and effective convergence, and something that also respects the history and trajectory of local organizing. So that's a bit of a big question, but can you talk a bit about that very short-term local dimension in terms of organizing against the G20 summit that'll be happening later this month?
Sure. Well, the first thing I think that's important is that, you know, it's been less than 4 months. So where are some of these other summits? You know, the RNC was about 18 months from when they started organizing, the Republican National Convention protests. They had about 18 months in which to organize, and we've had less than four. So I think while that's been a disadvantage in certain respects, it's also been an advantage for us because it's a short enough period of time that people don't have to abandon their other projects. There doesn't have to be this complete separation between people who have decided to kind of exclusively organize against the summit at the expense of other projects. So I think there is a good kind of healthy balance and synergy between local pre-existing collectives and projects and work against the summit. But certainly the short time frame does present serious logistical problems for us, and that has been an issue, is that, you know, we're trying to do all of this in a very, very short time period. You know, we do have a convergence center. We signed the lease on that. We've been going door to door. I've been involved in that effort. I actually think that is probably one of the most important and best work that we've done so far has been in terms of local outreach. One of our top priorities was to directly talk to people face to face and to go door to door, because it's something that we've talked a lot in the past, at least in Pittsburgh, about doing, but kind of never really got around to it for big protests. There was always something else to do. So this time we really wanted to do that differently, and we've been pretty successful so far. We've knocked on about 3,000 doors. We printed a newspaper explaining kind of from a non-activist-y jargon perspective, you know, what the G20 is, what its effects are, and it's a four-page newspaper. We printed about 10,000 of those. We've been taking those around, leaving them in places. Certainly all the trainings are happening. All the stuff that normally happens in conjunctions with these kinds of summit protests, at least in years past. And we obviously expect a significant turnout, and we obviously the state is engaged, and it's usual nefarious plots and the media is kind of going along with sensationalist stories about protesters stockpiling urine and feces and, you know, various plots that anarchists have to, you know, abandon dump trucks in the middle of roads. And, you know, there's the kind of raising of tension and kind of setting the stage for things like house raids and targeting of organizers. And pretty much all of the things that we're used to seeing are manifesting locally.
And it seems to me one way that the Pittsburgh G20 Resistance Project has responded to the potential of police and state repression and divide and rule is the Pittsburgh principles, which are a set of principles that you have on your website. Just to cite some of those principles, solidarity will be based on a respect for political diversity within the struggle and for social justice. We realize that our detractors will work to divide by inflaming and magnifying our tactical, strategic, personal, and political disagreements. For the purposes of political clarity and mutual respect, we will speak to our own political motivations and tactical choices and allow other groups and individuals to speak on their own behalf. And essentially, this is similar to solidarity statements that have been put together most recently in my local context for the Montebello meeting of the Security and Prosperity Partnership. There was a solidarity statement which was meant to maintain solidarity even though we do have disagreements and discussion within a broad movement. So could you talk a bit more about these Pittsburgh principles, where they came from in your context, and what purpose they're serving?
For us, we decided to do them after seeing how the protests were organized against the RNC last year in the Twin Cities. They had what was called the St. Paul principles, which we locally thought were very effective. They were kind of negotiated between the two kind of main poles of organizing in St. Paul, which were kind of the broader anti-authoritarian effort of the RNC Welcoming Committee and their local anti-war committee, which was putting on a mass permanent event. For us locally, we saw that and thought that it would also be very effective here, simply because there's always a great risk with these, that you're going to see the state try to co-opt and kind of legitimize the good protesters and kind of demonize the bad protesters and say that there's certain legitimate ways to resist, and then they kind of split the opposition and kind of try to use good protesters in the media to kind of essentially delegitimize people who choose to resist in other ways. And then on the other side of it, you see kind of the backlash that occurs from radical or anarchist or anti-authoritarian sectors who, you know, put down and kind of react very negatively to anything that isn't disruptive or that isn't non-state sanctioned. And we thought that, you know, given the limited time and given kind of the good working relationships that exist now between different parts of kind of the movement, I guess, whatever you call it, given those, we really wanted to maintain those. And so we felt that through negotiating and adopting these principles, that would at least increase the chance that we could kind of hold things together, at least through the end of the summit. I'd say that they've been pretty effective. Obviously, there's, you know, lapses on all sides, and it's a very stressful situation. And so people, you know, the media is constantly looking to try to get you into saying something about work that other people are doing. And people have done generally, with a few exceptions, very good job at that. And I'd say, at least personally, I'm very happy with how that's gone. And we have gotten many of the main organizing groups to sign on to them. So that's been very productive.
Alex, there seems to be a bit of a resurgence in targeting these summits. London, I think, was a big inspiration to people. It's great to see you organizing in Pittsburgh. I wish I could come down. I'm not much of a summit hopper, but I do think it's important to try to make it to these things when we can. Unfortunately, the border is too much of a barrier for some people, but best of luck to you with your organizing, ongoing organizing. Let us know about how it goes. We'll be paying a lot of attention and staying in touch about, you know, ongoing resistance to the policies that the G20 helped perpetuate. So thanks for talking with us on No One's Legal Radio.
Thank you very much. And honestly, it's some of the work that you all have done up there. I know I was at Quebec City, and, you know, very inspirational stuff in the past and in the current, and that has played a big part, at least in places like Pittsburgh, although they may seem far away, in how we've chosen to organize and what we've done. And so obviously we thank you all for that.